The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this May 12th in the year of our Lord 2022. Good morning to you. I hope you are having a great morning. NATO's having a good morning. Finland has announced it is going to join NATO. That's right. Finland is going to join NATO. The first major, major impact of the war outside of that is going on inside of Ukraine, outside of Ukraine, is the expansion of NATO. Second story from the Telegraph is Boris Johnson has said, Sweden, Finland in, British troops go there to defend them. And that is what the alliance is all about. Article 5 of the alliance of Vladimir Putin, congratulations, you've expanded and gotten rid of Finnish and Swedish neutrality thus far, as well as getting your hat handed to you in the first four out of five parts of the campaign. Russia, however, has, according to the Financial Times Signal, is about to annex Kherson in southern Ukraine as more and more of the Russian effort continues to be about the land bridge to Crimea, and perhaps a further push to Odessa. The war is stalemated at the present moment along a fairly intense line of fighting that we haven't seen since World War II. Ukraine has stopped Russian gas flowing to Europe through a key pipeline. That is a significant event for Europe. I don't know why Ukraine allowed Russia to make money on their pipelines when they were out killing. New war crime surfaced today, CNN with a chilling video of the execution-style murder of two citizens who had talked to Russian troops, turned around, were walking away back to their dealership, and they just got gunned down in the back. That's the Russian tactics. As the war grinds on, its global economic toll is surging, according to the New York Times this morning, as one would expect. But it is not just the fascist in Moscow, Putin. The totalitarian in Beijing is at it. Hong Kong police arrested Cardinal Zen, a senior Catholic prelate in the entire country, was put under arrest yesterday. He is depicted with the Heart of Mercy showing of Jesus at his office. He was later released on bail. He's a vocal proponent of democracy. Israel struck Syrian Golan in missile attack. They're very concerned. You know, they're getting very close to all-out conflagration there as more incidents come. Dr. Oren will join us later in this hour to discuss what's going on in Israel. In the United States, the Pennsylvania Senate race is front and center. David McCormick, whom I have endorsed, will be joining me next hour. The world is coming down on Kathy Barnett in the last 48 hours because she surged into third place behind Dr. Oz, who is fading. David McCormick, who is surging, and Kathy Barnett was getting close. So Dr. Oz took out after her. And his surrogates did, at least, calling into question her military service, calling into question her backstory, and publicizing her old tweets, which are pretty viciously anti-Muslim. I haven't reviewed this completely yet, but it seems to me probably disqualifying. She is also out there on the far edge of the election, stop the steal people, and that's not an electable position either. In the United, as we're about to see in Georgia next week, when Governor Kemp handily wins his primary against David Perdue, you can't run as an election denier. It doesn't work. And even if you believe it sincerely, and many people do, it's death in the general. People don't want to relitigate 2020. They're concerned about, what do you know, inflation and drugs. Inflation, of course, stayed at its 40-year high. They expected it to drop to 8% year over year. It only dropped from 8.5 to 8.3%. And we already know that May's number is going to be higher than 8.3%. Joe Biden's speech, of course, did nothing. Wall Street Journal, inflation slipped in April, but upward pressures remain. Prices for groceries rose, dining out, airline travel, other services, gasoline prices reached a new high this week. There is a very troubling story, and I may discuss this with Governor Doug Ducey, who's going to be my guest in the second hour today as well. Arizona's highly successful, 7.5-year governor of the desert state, twice elected by his Republican governor associates to lead them in their caucus, the Republican Governors Association, drug overdose deaths reached a record in 2021. More than 107,000 Americans died, two-thirds of them from synthetic opioids like fentanyl. We're not talking about OxyContin anymore. We're not talking about doctors overprescribing. We're talking about the cartels mixing up batches of fentanyl, putting them into pills that kids think they're taking some kind of amphetamine, some kind of maybe even heroin. This is 50 times stronger than heroin. Fentanyl, a drug up to 50 times the strength of heroin, has ratcheted up risks for drug users, reports the Wall Street Journal. There is a legal form, sometimes prescribed for managing cancer pain, but the main problems are illicit forms made in clandestine labs in Mexico, according to U.S. law enforcement officials. The drug is attractive to cartels because it is a synthetic, made from easily sourced chemicals rather than relying on crops like the poppies used to make heroin. U.S. deaths linked to heroin have been declining as fentanyl profile rises, but deaths linked to synthetic opioids, a category largely made up of fentanyl, climbed by 23% last year to 71,200 of the 107,000 deaths. There are also deaths, maybe 33,000, from methamphetamine and cocaine. And this is 33,000 cocaine deaths, 33,000 meth deaths, 24,000 cocaine-linked deaths, and 71,000 fentanyl deaths. Some of them are mixes of both of those. 36-year-old Alexander Gilman died last August with a mix of cocaine and fentanyl in his system, just 16 months after his stepsister died from a fentanyl overdose. I'm telling you, the election in the fall is going to be about schools and drugs and crimes and immigration and inflation. It's not going to be about Roe v. Wade being overturned. And to that point, the United States Senate, in a bipartisan opposition, rejected a bill by the abortion absolutists. I say bipartisan because Joe Manchin joined every Republican, so it was a 51-49 vote. 49 Democrats voted for late-term abortion yesterday. Abortion on demand right until the baby has been delivered into the hands of the OBGYN. The mother or the doctor can end that baby's life. And it's really the most radical bill ever proposed on abortion in the United States. Democrats voted for it, with the exception of Joe Manchin, unanimously. I don't think Maggie Hassan is going to be reelected in New Hampshire. I don't think Mark Kelly is going to be reelected in Arizona. I think that is it. Experts say, according to Aaron Blake in the Washington Post, that protests at SCOTUS justices' homes appear to be illegal. And Governor Glenn Youngkin of the great state of Virginia, of which I am a citizen, tweeted out, "We have been coordinating with the Fairfax County PD, Virginia State Police, federal authorities to ensure there isn't violence. Virginia State Police were closely monitoring, fully coordinating with Fairfax County and near the protests." They should be arrested. You can't try and intimidate a judge or a justice in an ongoing legal proceeding. I think most people will agree that's a very good idea. Last story of the morning in the New York Times. I got two more. In an uphill year, Democrats of all stripes worry about electability. And now, you know, they got their own problems. Kathy Barnett might be a walking L. I like Kathy. She was on the show. She has a very moving personal story. But I didn't know. Of course, no one was paying attention to the fifth person until she's very charismatic and very, very charismatic. And I didn't know about her tweets. I didn't know about the election denying. I didn't know about the military service issues. I didn't know about any of this stuff until this week. I'd already endorsed David McCormick, by the way, when this came out. And David McCormick is winning the undecideds. Dr. Oz is bleeding support to Kathy Barnett. Dr. Oz, it's just fading. And I think by a long measure, David McCormick is a much, much, much better candidate. It helps to have jumped out of airplanes with the 82nd Airborne. It helps to be a Bronze Star recipient. It helps to be from Pittsburgh. It helps to be, as opposed to Philly, it helps to be a very, very, very successful businessman whose wife worked for Donald Trump. McCormick is the guy. And I hope all you Pennsylvanians who are listening out there remember, we cannot lose that seat. Kathy Barnett has that Christine O'Donnell, Todd Akin vibe from the year when the Republicans could have won the Senate and we nominated some marginal candidates without vetting them. Meanwhile, my favorite story of the day, a passenger with, quote, no idea how to fly, lands his plane after the pilot became incapacitated. Two people on the Piper Cub in 75 miles north of Bacan. He said, I see the coast of Florida, but I actually don't know what to do here. Air traffic control got him on the ground. God bless air traffic control. And God bless everyone who's flying a plane today. I'll be right back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, bringing you the latest 1-800-520-1234. Connection 2, The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for tuning in. Coming up at the top of the next hour, David McCormick, who's going to be the next senator from Pennsylvania, if my prayers come true. I'm joined from Israel this morning by Dr. Michael Oren, historian par excellence. He's also the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister. He is now observing the government from the outside. And I bet you're glad you're on the outside because it's 60-60, Michael. And apparently 60-60. The coalition is going to use the joint list. Would you explain why that is a controversial move?
That's a controversial move. The joint list of Arab parties, extreme nationalists, who, how should I say this mildly, do not like the Jewish state. And don't recognize its legitimacy. They're in Knesset. They swear allegiance to its laws, but not to the state itself. And an Israeli government, a Zionist Israeli government, that has to depend on a non-Zionist and in certain ways anti-Zionist Arab party in the Knesset is not a government that has a lot of legitimacy.
So obviously they're looking ahead to next year's budget. If the budget doesn't pass, the parliament dissolves. Am I right about that?
Yep, that's in March. But that's a long time off, and many things can happen. Then that's a long time in Israeli politics, probably in any politics. But, you know, the Benjamin Netanyahu, who's head of the opposition, can put together a party, a government, by weaning some members of the coalition away and into the opposition. You could have no confidence votes. You could have crises. We have a crisis right now with the unfortunate death of the Palestinian journalists yesterday, which has caused quite a rift here. And it's caused further frictions between the Arab party that's in the coalition, the Ram party. So, you know, the Middle East, it's a roller coaster.
Turn to that, because I've tried to figure out who shot whom, and the Palestinians are not, the Palestinian Authority is not cooperating with the IDF. What is your assessment of the situation, Dr. Oren?
So last night I was talking to an Israeli journalist, and I said, just watch. The Palestinian Authority is going to say that they found a 5.56 bullet. The journalists. Now, the Israeli forces use 5.56. Palestinians usually use 7.62. It's a Kalashnikov bullet, but they also do have American A4s and M16s. And I also predicted that the Palestinians wouldn't cooperate with an Israeli offer for a joint investigation. And they rejected it. Even though the Biden administration asked the Palestinians to do it, they quickly closed the case. I heard this morning that they've already buried the body. You know, the Palestinians are making a calculation. Yeah, maybe the Biden administration will get a little aggravated, but the international community is going to come down hard on Israel. I was looking at the international press coverage. NBC had an item on it where they didn't interview any Israeli. They only talked about the grieving Palestinians, and the implication is that we are guilty even before we're judged.
And so if you had to make a guess, who do you think shot the unfortunate journalist? And it's a sad, very sad thing whenever a journalist is killed. Some friends have been injured over the course of years in various war zones, but it is a question of who shot the journalist, and I don't think we know.
Well, listen, we have pictures. The Israeli unit involved was a very elite unit that never fires on automatic, very, very careful in shooting. The Palestinians who were shooting at the Israelis were shooting all over the place on automatic. And, you know, as an old soldier, I'll tell you, once you shoot an automatic, you have no control over where those bullets are going. They're flying all over the place. And so, listen, my gut feeling is that she was shot by a Palestinian. We won't be certain until the IDF investigates, and that could take weeks. And now the investigation has been frustrated by the Palestinian refusal to hand over the bullet and hand over the body.
You know, that is usually a tell in America when someone is not cooperating with an investigation. Let me close by saying, last week we spoke on Israeli Independence Day. It was a bullion. We were celebratory. And that night, a horrific terror attack occurred. It seems like we're going back to the early 2000s when every time I opened up the Times of Israel or the Jerusalem Post, there was another terror attack, Michael Oren.
Yeah, I know we're not quite there yet. That was 1,000 Israelis killed. We're not there yet, but we can't you know, can't be cavalier about it in any way. And the reason these Israeli elite forces were in the city of Jenin was because most of these terrorists are coming from Jenin. And the Palestinian Authority's police force has lost control over Jenin. So we're being blamed when, in fact, it was the failure of the Palestinians and Palestinian terror that brought these forces into Jenin, and they were being fired upon. So what choice did they have but to defend themselves? Again, the journalist's death, Shireen Abu Afak, is a great tragedy. But we are at war with terrorists, and yeah. And they're shooting at us. They're killing us.
Last week's terrorists were 19 and 20 years old, and they killed the fathers of 16 or 15 children. I mean, what is going on that 19 and 20-year-olds wield axes and knives to kill dads? I mean, what has happened?
What has happened is that they're receiving instruction and encouragement from Hamas. Listen, they see instruction and encouragement from the Palestinian Authority itself, from al-Fatah. As a member of Knesset, we viewed films that were played on Palestinian television, actually instructing young people how to cut the throats of Israeli Jews with knives and with hatchets. Really, exactly like that. I came out of there sick to my stomach, Hugh. So that's how they get it. And they get it in the schools, they get it in the mosques, and they get it on their computer screens.
Wow.
And anybody can get a hold of an axe, anybody can get a hold of a knife.
Yep. That is the enduring problem, is that you can stop, you put up the wall, it reduces terrorism and suicide bombers, but wow, that was a startling day. Dr. Michael Oren, follow him on Twitter, Dr. Michael Oren. Thank you for joining me. I like my weekly update from Israel. Stay with me, America. David McCormick, big supporter of Israel, running for Senate in Pennsylvania. I have endorsed him. He's joining me next. We cannot lose that Pat Toomey-held seat. He's got to stay in the coalition. McCormick is your best bet. He is your strongest candidate. He is a Bronze Star recipient, a very successful businessman, and he is my guest next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning glory, America. Pennsylvania is already voting, and I am joined by Dave McCormick, who I've endorsed for the United States Senate seat in the Keystone State. So my affiliates from the Northeast down to Pittsburgh, from Erie down to Philadelphia, please tune your ear to Dave McCormick, because I think we got to hold this seat. It's a Pat Toomey retirement, and Dave McCormick is the most electable conservative in the race. Good morning, Dave. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, good morning, Hugh. Thanks so much for having me, and I'm really honored by your endorsement. So thank you so much for that.
Well, I may be in trouble with you, because I had Senator Cotton on, and I said, do you airborne guys in the 101st shake hands with each other in a secret way? He said, I think you just put Dave in the wrong division. He's 82nd airborne. That's where he got his Bronze Star. He said, oops, I hope he's still talking to me. So sorry about that. The 82nd and the 101st are very different divisions.
Yeah, for sure. Great, great soldiers, and great senator in Tom Cotton.
Dave McCormick, talk to me. The one thing I didn't know is I was getting ready to do the endorsement to the 8 people who live near Sharon on the Ohio border that listen to me. You got a PhD from Princeton. What was that in?
That was in international relations and economics. And, you know, it was at the time, it was the transition out of the Cold War. So I wrote a dissertation that became a book about how to transform the military, and how to make sure the military doesn't fight the last war, which sadly, I'm afraid we're doing right now. But that was the focus.
I'm always curious. Mike Gallagher's got a PhD, and usually David Petraeus has one. I think General Mattis has one. People go back and they study this stuff when they're professional soldiers. When did you decide to stop being a professional soldier after the Iraq War?
Yeah, came back from the Iraq War. I went to another Army school, and I volunteered for Korea. And then in the midst of that, the Army asked me to think about going back to West Point and teach. And so I applied to graduate schools and then made the decision to leave the Army. So I just continued on the graduate school path after 5 years of active duty service.
Now, you have served in other administrations. Your wife served President Trump. I am curious about the race on the ground. Pennsylvania is 5 different states, and I try and explain this to people. And I know one of them very well, since I grew up 7 miles from Sharon. But where is the race coming down to? Is it all about Philadelphia turnout at this point?
I don't think so. You know, I think the western part of Pennsylvania, where I'm from, is really, really important. That comprises a high 20% of the vote. And so I think we'll have a good turnout in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. And that's a real boon for me. And the Northeast, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, where I spent a lot of time in my life, is also a really important market. So, you know, Philadelphia is important, and we've spent a lot of time in Philadelphia, but all five of those markets are important. But I would say particularly for me, not only Philadelphia, but also Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, and the western part of the state.
Well, I'm on in all those places. Dave McCormick, I have a fourth grade granddaughter who is running for class secretary. So I helped her write her speech this weekend. I said, you have to ask people for their vote and tell them why you'd be good at the job. So make your pitch, Dave McCormick.
Yeah, thank you. Well, listen, I want to say, and I think you would agree, this Senate seat could not be more important. The stakes are so high because Pennsylvania needs a strong conservative fighter in the Senate. But this seat will also determine whether the Senate is led by conservatives and whether we have an opportunity to push back on the crazy extreme left that is taking our country in a terrible direction. And I feel that anger and that frustration and that fear wherever I go in Pennsylvania. And so we need a leader who shares the values of Pennsylvania conservatives, someone who is deeply connected to the state, and someone who can win this general election, because it's all about winning the general election and then going to Washington and being able to make a difference on day one, not needing on-the-job training. And so I'm somebody who's battle-tested. I've served for 9 years in the military. I'm a combat veteran. I created jobs in Pennsylvania. I was a CEO of a company in Pittsburgh that had 600 jobs. I then served at the highest levels of government. And I'm Pennsylvania true. I'm a seventh generation Pennsylvania. I have a family farm in Bloomsburg where I grew up. And my family is in Pennsylvania. My friends are in Pennsylvania. So I'm deeply connected to the state. And I'm deeply worried that if we don't pick the right candidate, the right nominee for the Republican Party who has those values and is able to win, we're going to not only take Pennsylvania in a bad direction, we're going to take the country in the wrong direction. And that's why I'm running, because I feel like I've lived the American dream. I've been blessed by everything Pennsylvania has to offer and everything America has to offer. And that American dream is slipping away, and we need patriots to step up and take the fight to Washington. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Now, Dave McCormick, I've watched the race very, very closely. I've had every candidate on except Dr. Oz, who has repeatedly turned down opportunities to come on this program, which usually evidences to me they don't know what they're doing on the conservative side of the issues. But I am now concerned. Kathy Barnett is rising in the polls, and she's a nice lady. I had her on the show. She's got sparkling charisma. But in the last couple of days, the Philadelphia Inquirer has unearthed her tweets and her record. And I don't think it's a Christine O'Donnell situation, a Todd Akin situation. How much does electability matter to Pennsylvania primary voters?
Well, listen, I've gotten to know Kathy on the campaign trail, and I like her. I respect and admire her personal story. But she's been tested already. She was tested a little less than 2 years ago, when she ran for a congressional seat in Pennsylvania and she lost by 20 points. And so, you know, listen, the stakes on this are so high for the general election because it'll be the biggest race in the country. We need a candidate, a Republican candidate that has credibility, has been tested, deeply vetted, can assemble the resources and the team necessary to win. This is like, this is going to the Super Bowl, the moment we go into this general election. And so that's why when I'm on the campaign trail, I'm making that case. I honestly, Hugh, when I walk out of a room, I rarely walk out of a room where I don't see heads nodding and people see that my background and experience is unique for this moment in terms of being able to win the general and being able to have huge impact in Washington. And people realizing that that I will be the only candidate in the race that can win the general election. Because Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are going to throw everything but the kitchen sink at our Republican nominee, and I'm ready for that fight.
That is exactly what's going to happen. And if I'm watching on election night, and I don't know if I'll be on Fox or wherever, I'll be on Special Report tonight. I hope the Pennsylvania Senate race comes up, and I'll disclose I've endorsed you, Dave McCormick. But once you win, I think you're going to win the primary. I think you're going to win the general. Once you win, you've served at the highest levels of the federal government. But you know that the Senate's a pretty weird institution, right? Pat Toomey has been a great senator for Pennsylvania, as Rick Santorum was. You're pro-life. You're just like those guys. How do you think you'll do in the Senate? You're a CEO, and the Senate isn't run by CEOs, though Mitch McConnell comes close to being a CEO. It's really 51 CEOs in the majority.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, the issues of this moment are issues where I have a unique ability to, I think, contribute. So when I'm driving across Pennsylvania, inflation is the number one thing on the minds of the people I deal with, and I'm seeing the Pennsylvanians, working families, elders on fixed income, small businesses, they're getting killed by inflation. Energy policy and unlocking the energy opportunity in Pennsylvania, which is incredible, and the war on energy by Biden's killing us, and secure borders. Open border policies are killing Pennsylvanians with fentanyl, the fentanyl crisis, crime in our sanctuary cities. So that's the agenda that I'll be able to jump and contribute on day one. And I know what to do about inflation. I mean, I've created jobs, I've run two companies, I've been at senior levels of economic policy. I know how to engage on these issues with credibility that I think will be unique in our caucus, unique among the senators that are there. And then I also have the military experience. And if you think about the world today, Hugh, and how we're being tested on the global stage, it's at the intersection of economic policy and national security policy. And there's no one in the Senate who has both those military credentials and experience and that economic policy. So I finally, and I'll say this, I'm not going there. I'm a practical guy. I've had success by finding a way to cooperate with others, but I'm not going there to make friends. I'm going there because I think our current path is deeply misguided. And I think we need people like me who are outsiders, who have no obligations to anyone other than the voters, to really push our country back in the direction that we need to take it. So that's the agenda that I'll take to Washington.
Two quick questions, Dave. I've been pushing for a long time that the Philadelphia shipyard needs to be renovated and part of the rebuild of the United States Navy. And I've been warning for a long time that John Fetterman is not an insignificant opponent. We got a minute. What do you say on those two things?
Agree with you on the first thing. Couldn't agree more. I also think we need an LNG port in Philadelphia, around Philadelphia, to get our natural gas to the world. It's a bountiful resource. On John Fetterman, listen, I don't take anybody lightly. And I think John Fetterman is an extremist. He's left of Bernie Sanders with his socialist agenda, but he's got a following. And he needs someone to go head-to-head with him who can show why the ideas he's promoting are a disaster for our country, and someone whose biography is a direct contrast to his. And mine is a combat veteran, West Point grad, compared to him as a trust fund baby and Harvard grad. Is a good contrast.
Dave McCormick, I hope everyone in Pennsylvania is listening. Everyone votes for the electable conservative in the Keystone State, Dave McCormick. Thank you, Dave. I don't know if we'll talk again before voting closes, but it's great to speak with you this morning. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hill. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Gives me great pleasure to welcome back a friend, Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona, in his second term. Many people call him, including me, the most successful governor in America. And I could spend a long time talking about a 2.5% flat tax, the border measures he's taken, the drug interdiction, the school choice, which has blossomed in Arizona like nowhere else. I could talk about Taiwan Semiconductor coming there. I could talk about the very, very sane and reasonable COVID approach. The most conservative state Supreme Court, given Doug Ducey's appointments or his work as the chair of the Republican Governors Association, elected that twice. But Doug Ducey, good morning. Welcome. I want to start with the first thing you did in office. How are you this morning, Governor?
I'm very good, Hugh. Thanks for having me this morning.
7.5 years ago, the very first bill you signed is a bill I wish it has passed in about another 30. I think you set the path for a couple of dozen other states. Tell us about how you get to graduate in Arizona.
Well, Hugh, you have to pass the American Civics Act. You have to pass the same test that a new naturalized American citizen has to pass. I just think it's so important that our young people know the foundations and fundamentals of what make our country so special and great. Some of the precepts from the Declaration and the Constitution, along with certain points of history. And then I hope our K-12 education system will continue to build on that so they understand their American civics and history along the way.
You see, a lot of conservatives spend their time rightly pulling out their hair over CRT, but not thinking about what ought to replace it. And the way back to sanity is to actually dust off things like the American Civics Act. And have other governors followed your lead on this?
Other governors have followed my lead on this. Believe it or not, this has been a bipartisan idea. Sure. And this idea is we're going to continue to discuss and debate, but let's have these arguments from our foundational documents like the Declaration, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers. And if we can whet that appetite for young people to understand how we got to where we are, how we've continually improved over the decades for this vision and goal of a more perfect union, perhaps they can see that they shouldn't look with such dispersion on people that came before us, that they were living in their own time. And 200 years from now, people will probably look back on us and think that we weren't as enlightened as them, but this should be the upward climb.
You know, the old saying about Western governors is that they always speak for freedom when nobody else does, and they're always more patriotic. That goes back to Ronald Reagan running for president in 76 and then successfully in 1980. Is there something about the West, Doug Ducey, that makes it less hospitable to the left-wing extremism that has swept some of the East Coast and our Ivy League schools?
Well, I do think because the West is so wide open, because it is so welcoming, you think of a beautiful place like Arizona, where over 70% of the adults were born somewhere else. So these people packed up their U-Haul truck and said, I'm going to move someplace where life is better. I'm going to pursue the American dream the way that I see it. And I do think the blue sky optimism that we enjoy out West is something that is, and I say this as a very proud son of Toledo, Ohio. It was a great place to grow up, but I thank God every morning that I live in Arizona today.
Yeah, we are Buckeyes both, and you can take the people out of Ohio, but you can't take the Ohio out of them. But it merges nicely.
That's right.
Yeah, but it merges nicely with the wide open spaces thing. Now, I am curious, Governor, about the school choice initiative that you put forward. Again, people are complaining about public schools. The answer is choice. What has Arizona done on choice?
Well, Arizona leads the nation on school choice. We're the number one state in the nation. We have over 550 charter schools. Those are public schools open to everyone with private management. Some of our most successful systems have an 11,000 kid wait list. We have 28% of our public schools are these charter schools. Over 20% of our children are in these charter schools. If you take those 20% of kids, that's the number one state in the nation in terms of achievement in math, reading, science, and American civics. And we've seen that also improve our district K-12 schools. So I do think that America never really solves a problem. We tend to innovate out of it. We think this innovation, like charter schools, like educational savings accounts, think backpack funding or scholarships, are the way to let a thousand flowers bloom, let parents make decisions on behalf of their children, different kids learn different ways, and let the marketplace help decide.
Now, when you became governor, you inherited a massive deficit, and somehow you managed to solve that and to cut taxes. What is Arizona's flat tax now?
Our flat tax is 2.5%. It's the lowest flat tax in the nation. And I did inherit a $1 billion deficit. And now that I'm heading into my final term and final year, I'm going to share the secret with other folks out there. How Arizona got out of that deficit is we simply spent less than we were bringing in, just like every family and small business does. We actually tightened our belt. Governments don't seem to do that, but it can be done, Hugh. And today we have fewer people by headcount in state government while having more child safety workers, more state troopers, but fewer administrators, fewer bureaucrats, and 400,000 new jobs in the state of Arizona, 52% population growth over the past generation.
You mentioned more state troopers, and you're taking me there. The big headline of the morning is 107,000 fentanyl deaths in the United States in 2021. That fentanyl is coming over an unpoliced federal border, Governor Ducey. What are you doing? You know, the governors can't do much. You and Greg Abbott do what you can. I'm not sure what Gavin Newsom is doing. But what are you doing to try and stop that since the federal government isn't?
Well, it's heartbreaking. It's a complete dereliction of duty of the Biden administration. I met with Customs and Border Protection yesterday. It was a very unsatisfying meeting. They're still looking for the root causes in South America. They don't realize the root cause is actually in the Oval Office. We have a border strike force in Arizona. Governor Abbott and I partnered along with 25 other Republican governors for an American governor's border strike force. That's a surge of more badges to the border out of our state budget and the Texas state budget. We deployed the National Guard, and we're also sharing intelligence with other states. When you talk about those heartbreaking fentanyl overdoses, those aren't just happening in Arizona. Those are happening in Omaha, Nebraska, Indianapolis, Indiana, and Toledo, Ohio. Every state today is a border state, and why Joe Biden will not pay attention to the southern border, which was largely solved under the Trump-Pence administration. The walls do work, surveillance works, boots on the ground work, and clear communication to Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras that the border is not open and you will be turned away if you make that dangerous journey and let these cartels try to take advantage of you and your life savings. So we really do need a partnership. If our southern border is not secure, neither is our nation, and that's how this poison is coming in.
Let's also talk, Governor, about Taiwan Semiconductor, because I think this is the future of America depends upon our supply chain getting solved. The worst part of the supply chain problem has been chips, and even President Biden recognizes that. How did Arizona land Taiwan Semiconductor?
It was a competitive process. We made the pitch. We stayed with it. It took several years. I think Arizona is the best place in the country to live, work, raise a family, and scale a business. The executives at Taiwan Semiconductor agree, and the size, scope, and scale of this project is overwhelming you. It's 667,000 square foot for a fab, and we're building 20 of those fabs. So the people that work there, the distribution, the supply chain, that they'll live in our neighborhoods, they'll go to our excellent public schools, and we're excited about that. They'll also enjoy school choice. The other thing I want to say about Taiwan Semiconductor is we do need the United States Senate to pass the CHIPS Act. These chips are in everything from our phones to our cars to our kitchen appliances. So when you see the slowdown in the supply chain, oftentimes it's because they can't get these manufactured chips. A lot of this is on our United States Senate that seems to be stuck on other issues or wanting to make this bill a Christmas tree rather than passing this so we can have continued supply chain smoothness and more of an increase in production in our semiconductor industry.
Now, Governor Ducey, before I turn to the RGA and the map, because I do want to catch up with you on the map, you're running the RGA's effort to turn some other state houses red. I want to talk about the Arizona Supreme Court. This is real inside baseball, but people need to know. The most, at least the equal of any conservative originalist court is in Arizona because you managed to put three or four justices on it. What did you look for when you put justices on the Arizona Supreme Court?
Well, thank you, Hugh. We are proud of the Arizona State Supreme Court. I do believe it is a conservative court because we look for strict constructionists. We look for people that want to embrace the Constitution. What I actually ask people through the interview process at the end, when they ask what I'm looking for, I say I'm looking for somebody who doesn't want to be governor or doesn't want to be a state legislator that will actually embrace the judicial branch and embrace the role of a judge and call balls and strikes and actually interpret the law rather than try to write the law. The first person I was able to name to the Arizona Supreme Court was Clinton Bolick, who at the time was the chief litigator at the Goldwater Institute. And since then, I think we've really been able to build on that with each successive nomination and confirmation.
Now, I want audience to know, I went through policy first so that people understand Republicans govern well and Doug Ducey, the equal of any of them. Now let's talk about the politics. What's the RGA see when it looks at the map for 2022?
Lots of opportunity. We're on offense, Hugh. We believe that these blue state governors are really going to pay a heavy price for their behavior during the COVID-19 pandemic, shuttering businesses, shutting schools, unnecessary vaccine and mask mandates. There's a lot of angry suburban moms out there and small business owners that want them to pay a price. We're going to protect our incumbents. Our incumbents have earned and deserved re-election. We're going to keep our red states red, but we're going to many blue states, and we've proven that we can win anywhere in the country already. I don't know if people know that we've already got Republican governors in places like Massachusetts with Charlie Baker, Larry Hogan in Maryland. Even Phil Scott and Bernie Sanders, Vermont, is the Republican governor. So we have good candidates. They're going through the nomination process right now. We've got a big winner the night before last in Nebraska. We're excited and confident that he'll follow Pete Ricketts. And then in a couple weeks, we've got Georgia, Alabama, following that, New Hampshire. And, you know, it's every Tuesday is going to be an exciting night. And then it's a race to November 8th.
That's what Maggie Thatcher used to say, win the argument, then you win the election. I think Governor Doug Ducey and his Republican colleagues in the RGA have done that. Governor, thank you for joining me this morning. Continued success on your time inside the Beltway.
Thanks so much. You really appreciate it. Great to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. Welcome back, America. I am Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening to The Hugh Hewitt Show. I am so pleased to welcome back Jim Talent. Now, I was just reading the headline about Finland joining NATO, and I want to talk to you about that, Senator Talent, former senator from Missouri. Finland and Sweden are going towards NATO. Finland announced it wants to do it. How significant is that, Senator Talent?
I think it's very significant, you, especially in the context of the fact that the NATO powers now understand that Europe is a net security consumer, not a security provider. In other words, I think and hope it means that the European countries are going to increase their defense budgets to begin providing more hard power deterrence by denial. And, you know, they have the ability to do that. They should be doing it. They started doing it under President Trump, and I think they're going to do more of it in the future.
Now, that does commit the United States to the defense of Finland. Is that that's a long border with Russia, Jim Talent. We are not committed to the defense of Ukraine. We are helping them, but we are not committed to send troops. If Finland joins in, Article 5 kicks in, right?
It sure does. The Finns are highly capable. I don't think we're going to have to put American forces there. I do think, and have advocated for some time, that a stronger posture, in other words, more American forces in Eastern Europe as part of combined NATO forces would be very very stabilizing. Had we done that in the years past, this Ukraine war may not have occurred. Instead, we went in the opposite direction. I've said on the show before that as of 2013, for example, we didn't have a working tank left in Europe. Well, we were signaling weakness and disinterest to Putin, and it encouraged his provocations.
Now, Senator, yesterday I was talking with Congressman Gallagher, who used the term going full Winchester, and he explained it for me and the Steelers fans. That means we've depleted our supplies badly of Stingers, Harpoons, and other missilery, and that it takes 18 months for America to produce a new missile, even though we know what we want and we know how to build them. There's an 18-month supply chain. That's simply unacceptable, isn't it? It's a missile world.
To begin with, I mean, it's been a while since I checked, but we would have exhausted our stockpiles quickly in the event of some kind of a major contingency in the Far East, for example. So we need to be stockpiling. We have shortfalls in current readiness. We have shortfalls in current inventory, and we are not prepared to have the systems that we need in the next decade either. So what the department needs to do is, as quickly as it can, build up the existing force for the rest of this decade while also providing for what we need to do in the 2030s. And the sequester is largely to blame for this.
General Mattis got there, he said his first task was resupplying the shelves. I'm afraid the next Republican president is going to have to do the same thing.
We're losing ground to inflation with the defense budget. I mean, the department's losing $4 or $5 billion a month to inflation. Jim Mattis also said that when he surveyed the situation after taking over, that no enemy on the battlefield has done more harm to American forces than the sequester. It was absolutely the worst possible thing that could have been done at the worst possible time. I'll say this for it. It was bipartisan anyway. So Washington managed to act in a bipartisan way.
And these continuing resolutions do the same thing. They're insidious in a way that nobody knows. They all we're sending you the same amount of money. No, you're not, and you cannot do contracts.
That's right. I mean, a defense appropriation, this sounds technical to the average person, and it is in a sense, but the department does not have authority to start new programs or issue new contracts on a continuing resolution. It needs an appropriations bill to do that. And it used to be that whatever else happened in Washington, they passed the defense appropriation bill every year. We did every year I was in the House and in the Senate. But in the last few years, the appropriations process has become so dysfunctional that they don't pass even a defense appropriations bill. Now, they do pass an authorization bill. We are getting into the weeds here now, and that's a good thing. But they need to pass an appropriations bill as well. And it needs to be at a much higher level. Everybody knows that. They just don't want to do it.
Well, let me close by asking you this, Senator. 8% inflation, 8.3% inflation, a war in Europe like World War II we haven't seen since then, and 107,000 fentanyl deaths. And Chuck Schumer brings to the floor the most radical abortion law. Of course, it's defeated 51-49. What is wrong with the Democratic Party?
Which he knew was going to fail.
He
did it, I guess, to make a point. I think it doesn't even make any sense from a political point of view.
Neither do I.
I mean, I just now it allows challengers to each one of these Senate Democrats to accuse them of the most extreme possible positions regarding abortion, which is not the position of the average American voter. So it doesn't make any sense. You know, when people consistently do something that doesn't even make any sense from a political point of view, you know, we are entitled to say, what kind of leadership is this? And I've been surprised to see some of the things that Chuck Schumer's done. I've worked with him a lot when I was in the Senate. So it's mystifying to me, but it's hurting the interests of the American people.
It's leadership in the thrall of the hard left faction of the Democratic Party, and it's unfortunate. Senator Jim Talent of Missouri, always a pleasure to talk to the retired senator. Thank you. Come back for hour number three, America, of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Kennedy. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Thursday, May the 12th, in the year of our Lord, 2022. Alex Gray is running for Senate in Oklahoma. He's been on here before to talk about Sooner State politics. And today we're going to talk defense issues because of his time as the chief of staff at the National Security Council under President Trump. Before I go there, Alex, though, when you were on last week, you kind of took on the tribes of Oklahoma. I think they noticed.
I think they did as well, Hugh. I think they took notice. And look, I had all five of the major tribes in Oklahoma put out a press release, very upset with my remarks about what I'm going to do on my very first day as a United States senator, which is introduce legislation to disestablish the historic reservations that the Supreme Court in the McGirt case in 2020 found in centuries-old legislation. And by disestablishing those reservations, Hugh, will solve the underlying problem that McGirt created. And you know, the fact that the tribal leadership is so antagonistic to what is this common sense solution to a problem that's affecting rank and file members of our tribes is really disappointing. And, you know, the tribes have come after our governor, Kevin Stitt. Unfortunately, the tribal leadership and groups affiliated with them have spent tens of millions of dollars attacking Governor Stitt. He's not backing down. I'm not going to back down. This isn't too important for our state to be influenced by this type of special interest pleading.
Well, what surprised me, the tribes in California, with which I am familiar, are a giant political force, and they spend billions of dollars in politics. But I am surprised that given the fallout of McGirt, which means basically you're not going to be prosecuted as rapidly or maybe not at all if a crime is committed on the traditional reservation of the ones that Justice Gorsuch found existed that nobody else knew was there, you're just not going to be, you're beyond state jurisdiction. I would think that the tribal members themselves hate that decision.
And this is the incredible part, Hugh. I think that's exactly right. And that's what every enrolled tribal member who's not a member of the leadership who I talk to all over the state is living, has a personal story of someone themselves or someone in their family or a friend who's been victimized by the McGirt case, you know, rapists and murderers literally being let out of jail because of the insanity that McGirt has undertaken. But you have a tribal leadership that is totally, I think, disconnected from the reality on the ground and is more interested in the power dynamics that McGirt has created in their favor than they are in helping their tribal members who are living with the consequences of this disaster. And so just like our governor has continued to stand up for what's right, and I would point out to you, even after tens of millions of dollars have been spent attacking Governor Stitt, he is the second most popular politician in Oklahoma after President Trump because he's doing the right thing. And I'll tell you, I will continue to push on this issue because it is the right thing to do for Oklahoma.
Now, Alex, I want to turn to your time in the Trump White House. You served all 4 years. The biggest job you held was as chief of staff in the National Security Council. Now, anyone who knows this show knows I'm obsessed with the 355-ship Navy and have been since the president promised it on the Philadelphia shipyard deck after he was elected and on the campaign trail. Secretary Esper called me a couple of times about his plans for the Navy. It was never for a 355-ship Navy. It was always for some, pie in the sky absurd plan, and he never got anything done. But he's out there saying he was for just tell me the truth. Who was for the 355-ship Navy? Was it Mark Esper?
I'll be candid with you, Hugh. Those of us at the National Security Council felt consistently that it was the Pentagon, led by Secretary Esper, who were doing everything they could to make it impossible to make 355 ships a reality. And the part that was so upsetting and disturbing about that is this is what the president of the United States campaigned on. You know, I was with him in Trump Tower in 2016. I was involved in that Philadelphia shipyard speech you referenced. That was something the president truly believed in and was passionate about. He was passionate about the industrial base aspects, about the idea of building an industrial base, not just to build 355 ships, but to sustain it and the jobs that would come from that and the strategic aspects of it. And unfortunately, Secretary Esper, by his actions, whatever he may have said, never bought into it. And so you had a situation where the National Security Council, folks like Ambassador O'Brien, like myself, like Mark Vandroff, who is our senior director for defense, were pushing and pushing and pushing to implement what the president repeatedly said in public and private was a major priority. And all you got from the Pentagon was obfuscation and delay and inside the beltway resistance tactics to doing something that I think most Americans would say, given where we are with the Chinese Navy, given where we are with what the Russians have been doing in the Black Sea, would say is just common sense.
Now, Alex Ray, Secretary Esper did not send me his book. I have not had a chance to read it. You know, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, all the Democrats send me their memoirs and I read them all. And I had Bill Barr. I read the books. He didn't want me to read the book. I think one of the reasons might be one of the things I've heard is he was not a fan of sending lethal aid to Ukraine. True or false?
Well, one of the things, Hugh, one of the things that I can certainly speak to is that despite some of the Beltway narrative that was pushed out there at different points in the Trump administration, the Pentagon, particularly large parts of the Army, was never in favor during the Trump administration of pushing lethal aid to Ukraine. And it was a open secret within the Trump administration that a lot of the uniformed Army was very much opposed to the type of aid, whether it was javelins and whether it was other things that President Trump and the political appointees under him were in favor of. And so there was absolutely a bureaucratic battle that occurred, particularly when Mark Esper was Secretary of the Army, to fulfill the president's commitment and the commitment of the political appointees under President Trump to get that lethal aid to Ukraine. And as you know, Hugh, by giving that lethal aid, we were able to deter Vladimir Putin throughout the Trump presidency. And we were able to prevent exactly the type of scenario that we're in right now. And unfortunately, again, despite whatever he may say publicly, the Army bureaucracy under Mark Esper's leadership was very much intransigent about getting that done.
I also want to turn to the U.S. Navy's two hospital ships, the Mercy and the Comfort. It seems to me I recall quite distinctly that Secretary Esper was not a fan of dispatching those ships to the East and West Coast, but President Trump said we're doing it, and then Secretary Esper showed up. Am I recalling that correctly?
No, you're recalling it exactly right, Hugh. And that was one of those moments that a lot of us really just were scratching our heads over. And it was, I think, a typical moment of Beltway, exactly what Americans don't like about how the Beltway operates, where you can go and you can make arguments behind the scenes against something and be very, very adamant about them. This wasn't how he thought resources should be used. You know, Mark Esper didn't think that in the midst of the worst health crisis since the post-World War I influenza crisis, we should be using Navy resources to help our most damaged and infected metropolitan areas. And then when that decision was ultimately made to dispatch those ships, he showed up to take credit. And I think that really is indicative of the type of leadership he displayed or lack thereof at the Pentagon. And I think it's indicative of the type of behavior that Americans are just so disgusted by from our Beltway elite.
Last question on Secretary Esper. I only talked to him twice. It seems sort of hapless to me. But I always believe in let your yes be yes and your no be no. Did the uniformed services have confidence in the secretary?
I could say very much the opposite of that. And look, I'm a huge proponent of civil-military relations in the sense of Mark Esper was the confirmed Secretary of Defense. The uniformed military should have taken his orders, and lawful orders, and executed them. And that's how it should work. Unfortunately, one of the important aspects of that is you also have to command the respect of the uniformed military to make that civil-military relationship work. And Mark Esper, for whatever reason, never did. And it made it very difficult for him to be effective in that role because he was never able to command that respect.
Well, I appreciate your coming on to talk about that. Let's go back to the Senate race in Oklahoma with 1 minute, Alex Gray. What's your closing argument? You got 6 weeks to go here.
Well, look, the closing argument, Hugh, is we're in a world where we need people who have national security experience, and we need people, conservatives, who on day one are ready to step in and to lead on national security issues and on the most sensitive issues that we're facing. And we also need leaders, people who are proven to have a track record of standing up to the Beltway swamp. I did that when I was at the NSC. I did that in the West Wing for President Trump. And I'll do it in the United States Senate every day.
Alex Gray for Oklahoma. Alex, always a pleasure. Thank you. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm coming right back. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In the 23 years I've been doing this national show, one of my favorite guests has been and remains David Gergen. You've seen David on CNN and PBS for years. If you've been a student at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government, you've probably taken his class. He's a professor of public service and founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's a good guy, and he joins me now. He's probably in Boston. He's probably rooting for the Red Sox, and he's probably still wrong about that. Good morning, David. Welcome back. Congratulations on Hearts Touched with Fire.
Terrific, you. I'm so pleased to be here with you. Thank you for you got me out, rousing out of bed, but you're quite where you are. You out in California?
No, I'm in the D.C. area now. I moved from California back to D.C. Okay. Because doing this from 3 to 6 in the morning would be a little bit hard. I go out there in the winter. David, I want to start because there's some people in the audience. I get new affiliates every month, and we have 450 of them right now. I want them to know that you work for RN, you work for Gerald Ford, you work for Ronald Reagan, you work for Clinton, but you have different sort of styles and roles for each of them. Let's start with President Nixon. What'd you do in the Nixon White House?
Nixon White House, I came in, I've been in the Navy. I went to law school, and then I went in the Navy for 3.5 years. My last year, Hugh, was I was assigned to come to Washington to work on draft reform. That was the time when Nixon had launched a random lottery to determine what draft number you got and whether you're going to go to Vietnam or not. We tried to clean that up. They ran a bogus, in some ways, a random lottery the first year out. I'll tell you, you have time for a little story?
We got lots of time. That's why we can go a long time today.
Okay, super. Well, so Nixon, out of the White House, orders a random lottery determine who goes to Vietnam. The Lewis Hershey was then head of the draft. He was sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of the draft. And so Hershey did something they did back in the Second World War, which was a very popular war. They got a bowl, they got capsules, and they put January 1 in the first capsule, put it in the bowl, and then January 2, all the way to the days of January, then February, all the way up through the days of December, the last ones into the bowl. Got a spoon, stirred it up a little bit, put it in the closet. And then on the day of the random lottery, they brought out the bowl, reached in for number one, you go to Vietnam, and it was like November 15th. And all of the early numbers and all of the early draws, you know, were from late in the year. So the whole thing was tilted, in a way.
How interesting.
So, yeah, it was very interesting. And then our charge was, a small little group, was to come up with a truly random system that would buy public trust. And we reached out to a statistician named Tukey, who was a Princeton man, who was a leading statistician in the country, and said, how do we run a random lottery that's truly random? And he said, well, listen, get the bowl, get the capsules, but then use a computer to randomly generate the order in which the capsules are put into the bowl. So that makes it truly that was a good idea. So
it was.
My contributions to this were two. I said, listen, some senator's son is still going to get a very high number. They're going to think it's fixed in the bowl. So let's have two bowls. Put January through December in one bowl and the numbers 1 through 365 in the other bowl, and then draw simultaneously from the two bowls and match up the number, the date with the number.
Oh,
there's nobody can say that's not random.
No, double randomized trial. My brother won the lottery. He ended up being, he's the last Hewitt boy that was eligible, and he was in the high 200s, and he didn't go.
Yeah.
And so that meant a lot to people.
Sure. Well, listen, so my other contribution was, listen, let's find two young blonde girls, very innocent looking, fairly short skirts, and have them do the drawing. we had the first Randall White, was that, who was that woman who used to put things up? At any rate, it went down. What I discovered about government, and it's gone with me the rest of my life, is part of it is about business and real policy, and that's meaningful. But also there's part of it's about showbiz.
There's also a part of it that is storytelling, as you talk about in Hearts Touch with Fire.
Yes.
You also work for Ford. Now, Jerry Ford, Jim Cavanaugh is the chairman of my board at the Nixon Library, the chairman of the Ford board. And we've talked a lot about Nixon and Ford and their differences. Jerry Ford could never get elected president from the go. I mean, he could have won re-election. He could have won in 76 had things broken differently. Part. What'd you do for Ford?
What did I do for Ford? Well, I stuck around. During the Nixon years, I was first hired by Ray Price to come in and be his assistant. Ray was running a speechwriting shop, speechwriting and research. And I was his sort of go-to gopher guy. I was very junior at the time. I got promoted up through the ranks. And then Ray at one point said, I'd like to be sort of a senior counselor. And I was asked by Bob Haldeman if I would run the speechwriting and research shop. So which I did, and for about a year and a half, and through some pretty tough times, as you recall. But in any event, by that time I was sort of in, and when Ford came in, they named a replacement for me without asking. I immediately was looking around for a job, and I called Bill Simon, who was Treasury Secretary, and had become a friend, and he said, listen, come work for me. So I went over to the Treasury Department for about a year. And over there, I tried to teach them about politics, or at least to the extent I understood it, and they tried to teach me about economics.
When I read Hearts Touch with Fire, it's kind of like a diary for me, because the wonderful and great Ray Price brought me to San Clemente to be a ghostwriter for Nixon in his exile.
Right?
And as mentors. And this is a book about mentoring. And so I wanted to bring that up. But I also want people to know, I went to work in the White House as a young lawyer for Fred Fielding in the Reagan years, but you were kind of higher in the chain of command. I'd see you in the mess, but I wouldn't talk to you because you didn't talk to the people higher in the chain. tell us what you did in the Reagan years.
Well, in the Ford years, eventually, let me tell you one little Ford story.
Please.
You have time?
Oh, yes.
So Ford, as you recall, this is a real story about his staff, actually. As you recall, Ford was giving, when I went back, I was invited by Ford to come back. Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney reached out and said, come on back to the White House under Ford, which I did. And I was sort of named, some advisor to the president. I was still fairly junior. The speech writing process in there was excruciating, because the way we would review for a speech where the president was about to make was on Mondays we would get together and we'd have all the speeches he was going to give that week. We'd have drafts. and we'd sit down, and nobody had ever seen, except in the speechwriting staff, nobody had ever seen the speeches until we got into that meeting. And then the way we critiqued the speech was everybody would go to page one of the speech, and we'd read it for the first time. And then we would make comments about where what needed to be changed. Then we go to page two and page three. It was excruciating. I couldn't stand it because we never read the full speech. We had no idea where the speech was going. And it was like, and we wound up giving a lot of speeches or sort of, you know, one syllable speeches, you know, Dick and Jane. But anyway, after we left the White House, after Ford was back into private life, about 6 or 8 months in, I got a call from his office saying, President Ford's got a speech he needs to make. He's got a draft. He'd like you to look at the draft. Can he call you at home tonight? I said, sure. So I got the speech. It was elegant, 3-4-syllable words, well-constructed, very persuasive. And so I thought it was a beautiful speech. The only problem is it's not a Ford speech.
Uh-huh. You know,
it's not see Dick run.
Yep.
And so he called me that night, and he said, well, what'd you think? And I could hear him puffing away on his pipe. And I said, well, Mr. President, it's a very good speech, but it's not your speech. Do you want me to rewrite it in your hand, you know, in your way of thought? And he started chuckling this. And I said, what? Well, what's happening? He said, actually, David, this is the first time I've had space in my life that I could, for a number of years, that I could really write my own speech. This is it. And I thought, oh, my God, for these last 12 to 18 months, we've been having this guy give terrible speeches that aren't his. They were, you know, we way oversimplified.
When you came back, the speech writing process when I was a young lawyer was staffed around. I remember the Chief Justice of the United States at that time and Associate Counsel arguing with Peggy Noonan. That was a murderer's row of speech writers over which you presided.
Oh, yes. We had Bill Sapphire and Ray Price and Pat Buchanan.
And Nixon, yeah. There.
And with Nixon, yeah. And then John McLaughlin came in sort of late in the game with Nixon, but, you know, he was around for a while.
Ben Stein. Yeah.
So, it was a terrific group. And it was about 50 people. If you looked at speech writing and their support staff and then the research staff. And then we also had the letters and, you know, so correspondence section. So it was about 50 people there. And I ran that for a while.
So let's go to Reagan, because we've got 2 minutes of the break. We'll come back after the break.
Sure.
What happened? What did you do for Reagan?
Well, I was very close to Jim Baker, and he was my mentor for much of that time. And during the interim period, when Reagan was, I was in a campaign. I was in two campaigns against Reagan, and the first one we lost, the second one we won. And I was working for George Bush during that campaign. And then Reagan asked the day after he got elected, he asked Baker to be his chief of staff.
Right.
And Baker then reached out to me and to Dick Darman and Craig Fuller to some extent. But there were two groups of people in the Reagan White House. There were the Californians, who tended to be more conservative, but had worked with Reagan, like Ed Meese, had worked with Reagan in Sacramento. And they had a very good relationship. Bill Clark, it was a good group of people. But they were all sort of Californians, had very little Washington experience. So Reagan then assembled a second group, which was headed up by Jim Baker, which we were called the pragmatists, people who were, you know, the Marty Andersons, the conservatives would come up with a policy. It was our role in life as a pragmatist to get them passed, to get things done.
Well, I got to ask you, where does Fred? I had breakfast on Saturday with Fred Fielding and Dick Houser. I always thought the lawyers were a group apart. Where do they fit in your triangulation in the White House? Because basically, Fred took care of Nancy and the president's big stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. But Fred worked about four doors down the hall from me.
I know. I know you guys are pals.
Yeah, and he's a super guy. But I remember when Nixon resigned, I got a call just after Nixon made his speech on TV. I got a call from Al Haig, who was then the chief of staff. And Haig told me, he said, listen, David, everything has worked out well. We forgot one thing. I said, what's that? He said, we forgot a resignation letter. I said, that's really interesting. I'll look forward to reading it. He said, no, you don't understand. I want you to write it. I said, well, what do I say? You know, how do you resign from president of the United States? And he said, I don't know. You figure it out. And so I went down the hall to see our general counsel, thought John Dean could give me some good counsel on how to do it right, properly. And then I was reminded that John Dean was in jail.
Yes.
So we had our general counsel was in the slammer, and that's when I turned to Fred Fielding. And Fred and I worked on it overnight, and he's just a marvelous human being.
And he's a fabulous lawyer.
Yeah, and he's a good lawyer, and he had this Philadelphia firm he worked with, and he's very high on my list of people I learned a lot from.
When we come back from break, we're going to talk about President Clinton. I want to get a few stories, and then I want the big takeaways for young people. And boy, there are a lot of big takeaways in Hearts Touched with Fire. I'm going to have Dave Gergen tell a couple of stories, my favorite stories in a book full of them, and my favorite bits of it. I have one disagreement with him, and I'll talk about that, too, because it's talk radio. We got to do that. But David Gergen, ubiquitous in your life, whether you knew it or not, for the last many years. And as long as David keeps working, so am I. So don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back with David Gergen. Hearts Touched with Fire, available at Amazon. We'll be right back after the break on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, talking with David Gergen, the author of this brand new book, Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. David had the unusual distinction of crossing over to serve in two White Houses separated by party. He joined the Clinton White House. There he worked with my closest friend in the world, Mark Guerin, who's now the director of the Kennedy Institute of Politics, so he must run into Mark a lot up in Boston. But, David, when Bill Clinton asked you to go to work for him, were you surprised? And what did you do for the Democratic president for whom you toiled?
Yes, but first of all, let me just say, you and I share a lot of good friends, and Mark Guerin is one of them.
Yep.
He's first class, too. When I was out in the private sector, when Bill Clinton was elected, and I was at that point, I was running U.S. News and World Report. It was my first foray into formal journalism, and I lasted for a couple of years, and it worked out well. But in any event, I wrote editorials for the magazine, and I got a call one day from Mac McClarty, who was the chief, who was very close to Clinton. He was his first chief of staff, and I think a good one. And he said, "Will you come over and have lunch with me?" And I said, "Sure." The White House mass, you bet I'll come
over. You bet,
So we had lunch, and he said, "Well, we've been reading your editorials about what we ought to do over here, and we think maybe you ought to come here and work on our staff and tell us what to do." And so I was a little bit taken aback by that because I had worked for three Republican presidents, and probably so. I wasn't as conservative as presidents I'd worked for, but I worked for them with great respect, especially Ronald Reagan. But I also had a lot of high regard for much of what Richard Nixon stood for, as well as Gerald Ford. So, but anyway, it was a surprise to me. But while we were sitting there in the basement there where they had the little restaurant, the president himself shows up to talk to me, and I knew that the fix is in here. And so the two of them leaned on me to come and work for Bill Clinton. And I said, it was in a very awkward situation because the partisanship was pretty high by then. But I'd known Bill Clinton a long time. We had become friends. And I sort of had an old-fashioned view that if the president of the United States calls you and says, "I need help, can you come help me fix what's going on here?" You do it.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, and then the answer is also, when do I start?
Yeah.
And I told him, Mr. President, I can do this for up to a year, but I don't want to be involved in campaigns against Republicans. That's just it would be too awkward. And so we agreed to that. I settled in as counselor to the president. When I got there, the reason he asked me to come was he was looking for someone to help guide him out of he was floundering. I knew a Bill Clinton who was very self-confident, good, great governor of Arkansas. And the Bill Clinton I found in the White House was despondent. Things weren't going well. He was bouncing around and he was looking for help. And so what I had learned from the Reagan years was when people used to say, "Let Reagan be Reagan." You always play to the president's best instincts, his best qualities, and that will help him more than anything else. And so I had a sort of let Clinton be Clinton approach. And the deal was that I pushed very hard. Don't try to change who this guy is. Don't make him somebody he's not. Let the good Bill Clinton come out and bring back to the fore, Clinton, the best of Clinton. So we created the zone of confidence around him, self-confidence. He'd lost his self-confidence. He was struggling. And Hillary was struggling. She found the transition to Washington very, very difficult. You know, when they lost Vince Foster, there were a whole lot of things going on that were negative. And so in any event, each time the president did something, Bill Clinton did something, he turned to me afterwards and said, "How'd that go? What do you think? What should I do to change?" And gradually he got his self-confidence back. And what I learned is with leaders, you try to help them refine themselves. Don't try to turn them into something that they're not, because that will, the lack of authenticity will really come back to haunt them later on.
Now, that leads me to two of the stories. Sure. There are many stories in Hearts Touched with Fire, and I want to use my two favorite, with Bill Clinton in Morocco and with H.W. in Kennebunkport. Yeah. Do it in the order that you want, because they illustrate magnificent things.
Well, let me start with the order in which they occurred. It was the Kennebunk with George Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush. This was during the out years, during the Carter years, when Bush was running, wanted to be the next nominee of the Republican Party, and he had a reasonable shot at it. And he was building a staff. He reached out to me. I didn't know him well. He reached out to me and said, "Would you consider coming on my political staff for the campaign?" And I didn't know him well. And I said, "Well, let me think about it." So the next thing I know, he called him, invited me to come stay at Kennebunk for a weekend.
Now, pause right there, David. We got to take a quick break, and I want people to know you're on your way to Kennebunkport to talk with George H.W. Bush. When we take the break, we're going to, on the other side of this break, America, we're not going to have any more breaks. We're just going to talk, so we won't interrupt David anymore. The book is Heart Touched with Fire. The whole podcast and this radio interview will be available later today over at the podcast and on the radio show. I'm going to excerpt some of this tomorrow, because you got to hear the story about H.W. and the one about Bill Clinton and where we disagree about young people, where we agree about young people. Hearts Touched with Fire, really wonderful book for young folks and old. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be back now on other affiliates and on the Highly Concentrated Hue podcast with David Gergen. When we went to break on the radio show, David, you were saying the George H.W. Bush was running for president in 1980. He wants you to join the team. He invites you up to Kennebunkport.
Yes, exactly. So I get to the airport about 20 miles away, and I'm looking around for a driver. Couldn't find a driver, and then I was asked to report to some desk there in the airport terminal, and I did, and there's Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush, who had driven these 20 miles to go pick me up, and I was like floored. I mean, I just assumed, like, look, I'm pretty much a flunky here. I mean, why you drive? I was very impressed, and then I went home with them to their home, and what I discovered was they had a Democratic congressman as a guest for the weekend. You know, and in a partisan world, that was just sort of unheard of. But I was very pleased to see that, because they were friends. They had been longtime friends, and they got together. And I spent a wonderful weekend. Then I was leaving on a Monday morning. I had a plane out of that same terminal. At 5:30 in the morning, there was a knock on my door, my bedroom door. And I opened it, and it was George H.W. Bush. And he had a cup of coffee, and he said, "Here, I thought you might need this to get started." And he was so gentlemanly. It was so warm. And when we got to the airport, he said, "You know, I'd like to get to know people before I ask them to serve on my staff, and I'd like to get to know who they really are. And that's why, you know, we behaved the way we did this weekend. We really wanted to get to know who you are."
That's such a takeaway for leaders. Don't hire on resumes. I mean, resumes matter, but don't hire on a resume, because if you don't get along with someone, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton in Morocco.
Bill Clinton in Morocco. So Clinton is makes a trip to the Middle East. It's partly, you know, remember the whole throwing out of the Iraqis Hussein out of Kuwait and everything
Correct.
Like that. I was asked to go with him. We have a party. President usually travels with a party about 10 or 12 people. And then a lot of security and all the rest. But in any event, they asked me to go, and I was delighted. And I'd been to the Middle East with Nixon, but I was always interesting to go back and instructive. But I got back on Air Force One and to come home. And we stopped in to see the King of Morocco on the way home. And we arrived at the airport there about 1 a.m. in the morning. We jumped into some vans, went in to see, went to the palace, had coffee with the king, jumped back into the vans, went back out to the airport, started to fly home to the United States. We spent about 2 hours there on this trip to Morocco, which was one of the most beautiful countries in the world. And so on the way back, I had a chance to talk to Clinton. I said, you know, Mr. President, this is so different from the way it just illustrates the differences that are between the way we govern today and the way people govern back in the war. And I said to him, you know, there's a story about Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt during the war. Early on, Churchill was eager to get to know Roosevelt better. He wanted Roosevelt to trust him, and he wanted to be able to, you know, get ships and planes and everything else from Roosevelt. So in any event, the two leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt, agreed to meet in Morocco. And when they got there, Churchill turned to Roosevelt and said, I'd like you to stay an extra day because I want to show you the sunset in Morocco with the Atlas Mountains. And Roosevelt really didn't particularly want to stay. He wanted to get home. But Churchill said, no, you have to do this, Mr. President. Come do this. And so they went. And they had to drive 5 hours, I think, from the capital out to where we're going to stay. And in the late afternoon, their group of Secret Service guys carried Roosevelt up to the top of this little this building that was religious building of some sort. And Roosevelt and Churchill watched the sunset over the Atlas Mountains. It's a glorious sight. But they bonded during that time, and Rosa and Churchill also made a watercolor. He painted a watercolor, and was the only one he did during the war, and gave it to Roosevelt as a friendship sign. But I told Clinton, you know, here it is in the middle of a war, intense war, existential war, that these two men would take a day out to go get bonded and watch the sunset in Morocco, and not be so overcome by the day to day. You know, pressures of war, and they were living real lives. They were genuine people, and going to Morocco actually was a really smart use of the president's time. But in the modern day and age with Bill Clinton, you had to fly in and fly out a matter of 2 hours. You had in the middle of the night. You didn't see anything. You didn't take advantage of that. I said, Mr. President, you know, it's too bad. You have to rush home, and you can't take advantage of this and sort of. Imbibe this kind of environment because it was so important to the Roosevelt Churchill relationship.
Andrew Roberts unfolded that story in his book Walking with Destiny, and when you recounted it in Hearts Touched with Fire, it reminded me that you can't spend too much time with the people who matter the most on the world stage. And the Absolutely. King of it's just unfortunate. Let me turn now. These are just ways of setting up to people. That young people who read this book are going to take away some lessons. And I love the network effects are real. You've got to have a network of friends. It's that Guerin connection, for example, the Ray Price connection. We have network effects between and CNN and Jeff Zucker and all these different people. We go on forever. But young people, here's where we might disagree. You begin the book by talking about Greta Thunberg and David Hogg and Daniel Crenshaw, Lieutenant Crenshaw, now Congressman Crenshaw.
Yeah.
And to me, the biggest danger for young people today is celebrity early. Now Crenshaw came to it after being a CEO and losing his eye, but Thunberg and David Hogg came to it early. I mean, it's such a burden, David. You've lived with it for 50 years. You know what it's like to be a celebrity. And do you worry about young people becoming famous too early?
Well, I think that is I think that is a danger. You know, famously, in politics, it used to be that if you were sort of fairly new to politics and you became a celebrity, say like an Al Haig, when he was over at the State Department and he was they had a cover of Time magazine with him being the vicar.
The vicar.
The glove. Yes. He was sort of going to run the world. You know, it was terribly damaging to him inside because people were very resentful. The celebrityhood had gone to his head. He didn't conduct himself in a way that really sort of made strong friendships. And eventually, you know, the system coughed him out. He didn't fit very well. And eventually Reagan let him go as Secretary of State. I had worked with Al back way back in the Nixon days, and he was marvelous at running the country during the when Nixon was in such trouble. Al Haig kept the the government together, but by the time Reagan came along, Haig had become this celebrity figure, and it got in the way. Yeah, so I do think there's a danger of that. I think there's an equal danger for the young people of the millennial generation and Generation Z, even for the Generation X, that, and this is my personal observation, is they have enormous promise. But there are some people in that in those groups, who are accused, and I think rightly so, of being very, extremely arrogant, being entitled, having a low, low drive and low sense of, how you have to work hard to pull something together to make things work. And they just sort of will follow themselves.
You talk a lot about the virtues of modesty, which I greatly appreciate. Now, I know Mark Zuckerberg a little bit. He's not immodest. He is very successful. But you can only have one. I've had dinner with him at his house with a bunch of other conservatives. Yeah. You can only have a dining room table that seats 12 if you want to have a conversation, no matter how many billions you have.
Yes, I agree.
And so a modest life is just fine.
Yes, I have a friend, Jeff Walker, who lives in Florida these days. But he has this whole idea of a Jeffersonian dinner, and that is you put 12 people together, but no more than 12.
Right.
And you have periodic conversations, and people go deep, and they're candid. And those are the good kind of the meals, as opposed to the I knew one person in the Nixon White House who spent an hour every day finding ways he could get a White House operator to call him somewhere in a public place so that he would be summoned.
All right, two more things I want to cover. People have to read. But two more things. The strenuous life. I've never not had four jobs. You're the same way, Gergen. You're everywhere all the time. And you talk to people about, don't expect this to be one job, be an influencer, and have people send you checks. It doesn't work that way.
I agree. And what I've discovered to you is that for young leaders, you change jobs these days so often that what you really want to do is build a reputation for who you are.
Yes.
For you is sort of like you at Inc. And people look to you and know by word of mouth, how good you are. And that's when things start happening and people bring things work to you. You don't have to go out and search for it. I can't remember for a long time when I had to go look for a job, because usually there was somebody there who wanted me to and I bounced around. You bounced around some.
Oh my gosh!
But it makes a bit.
You can't hold a job if you're me and you. I mean, because people want you to do stuff. So that brings me to the last point. I interviewed General Mattis out at the library,
when did you do that?
Mad Dog Mattis is an amazing book. I mean, it's really one of the most remarkable books I've ever met.
Yes.
He said, call me Jim. Yeah. And I said, I'm married to a Marine Corps colonel's daughter. I'm going to call you General forever. But he said, he has 7,000 books in his library.
And
you and he and I believe in one thing, which is reading, reading, reading. Just expand on that for young people.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about it is, if you want to be a leader, You can have classroom experiences, but there's nothing like going out and being in the arena itself and learning. And one of the ways that you can prepare yourself well for the public arena, whether you want to be in politics or policy or whatever it may be, is to become self-educated. To realize that you need to do some reading on your own, just as you need to develop your own values, what you believe in, what your purpose is in life, what your moral purpose is in life. You need to figure that out for yourself. And reading and becoming a reader, I think it really strengthens you. I was out at the Harry Truman Library once, some years ago. Wonderful library, because there was humility about it. It wasn't one of the big, massive kind of libraries that presidents now have so often. And I was looking through some stuff, and I thought Truman was a wonderful president. He was starchy and he was very strong. But Truman never went to college. The only president in the 20th century never went to college because his family was too poor when he graduated from high school. And he worked for 7 years behind a mule on a family farm before he went on to a haberdashery and to political life. And Truman gave a speech. He had developed a speech he gave to the visiting high school students. And he used to tell them these high school students. Not every reader is a leader, but every leader is a reader. I climbed onto that, and I'm glad you mentioned General Mattis. He and I have been talking, and he was very helpful in endorsing my book, and he and I would like to go out and do some things together. Because I've been with him 2 or 3 times. I don't know him as well as you do. But I share your great respect.
I've just interviewed him. That's all. And I envy you that opportunity. And I envy you writing a book as heartfelt and as important as Hearts Touched with Fire. David Gergen, always good to talk to you. Make sure Garen's on the right path. And I hope I see you down the road in the Beltway sometime.
That would be my pleasure and my privilege to you. Take care and thank you.
Thank you, David Gergen.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.